Hi, and welcome to The Thing About Cotton, a podcast brought to you by the International Cotton Association. We are your hosts, Imar McDonough, Camille Cluzel, and Katie Farron, members of the ICA's Women in Cotton Committee. Join us as we explore the anatomy of the cotton value chain and bring awareness to the industry through highlighting female leaders and achievement. So, the thing about cotton is, it's more than just a fabric we wear. It's a global commodity that plays a crucial role in communities around the world. As we've mentioned in previous episodes, cotton is grown in more than 50 countries and more than 100 million households depend on cotton production for their livelihood. But where is cotton produced? When is it grown? How is it harvested? So let's go back to the very start of the supply chain, cotton farming. In the 2023-24 crop year, which runs from August through July, over 113 million bales of cotton were produced globally. In 24-25, the USDA currently estimates this number to rise to 117 million bales, with the major producers in China, India, the United States, Brazil, Pakistan, Australia, West Africa, and more. Today, we are excited to bring to you the first in a new series of episodes about the main cotton-producing countries and the farming practices and systems within them. A few weeks ago, from August 6th to 8th, over 2,800 people from across the cotton industry came together in Gold Coast, Australia, for the Australian Cotton Conference, which takes place every 2 years to discuss all things Aussie cotton. Off the back of this conference, we will begin our series on cotton farming practices in Australia. In Australia, cotton farming is primarily concentrated in New South Wales and Queensland, but with new areas opening up in North Queensland, the Northern Territory, and Western Australia. With around 1,500 farms producing what is known to be some of the best quality cotton globally. Despite being a relatively small player relative to other cotton-producing countries, the USDA estimates Australia's 24-25 production at 5 million bales. Australia is one of the top exporters of cotton globally, thanks to its efficient farming practices and high-quality output.
Thanks for that introduction, Katie, and we're very happy to welcome Lauren Rogan, who is an agribusiness professional with both corporate finance and operational agricultural experience. She's a self-titled farmer in training at Tyunga Farms on the Darling Downs in Queensland, and she works alongside her parents, Jonas and Scarlett, and the team of five employees to farm 2,600 hectares of largely irrigated crops. Cotton is the commercial focus of the production system, and Tyunga is MyBMP certified, and all cotton produced is Better Cotton accredited. The team was honoured to have won the 2023 Australian Cotton Grower of the Year Award, in particular recognition for their water use efficiency, integrated pest management practices, use of organic fertilisers, and commitment to record keeping. So keen to get more involved as part of the next generation, Lauren joined the family business in October 2023. She brings to the role a corporate perspective, having spent 7 years working in corporate agricultural roles, first with PwC in their mergers and acquisitions team in Brisbane, followed by a position as analyst with Ost-On Corporation in Melbourne. She now shares her time between Tyunga and a corporate role as an associate director in the corporate advisory firm LAWD. She is a very strong advocate for all things agriculture, particularly cotton, and she serves as vice chair of the Future Farmers Network Board of Directors, and she is also a contributing member for the Royal Agricultural Industrial Association of Queensland's Future Directions Committee. Lauren, a very impressive bio, and I first met you earlier this year when you were presenting at a forum in Sydney, a cotton forum that was bringing brands and retailers and Australian industry people together, and you were presenting on more crop per drop, and there's a lot of things in your bio that we want to talk to you about today regarding your farming practices. But thank you for joining us from Brisbane.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Lauren, just a little bit of background on your family. You're a second generation cotton farmer, so but your family migrated from Germany, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So my parents are German born and bred. I'm Australian born and bred. So they met in their late teens in Germany and were very keen on farming. Dad having grown up in a farming family, mum not so much. So, yeah, they sort of looked abroad at what opportunities there were because there weren't quite as many in Germany. It's not quite like Australia and other countries where you can buy farms and, you know, start from scratch if you want to. So they landed on Australia and, yeah, moved out in the early 90s and have been here ever since. they actually started, when they first started farming here, it was in a share farming capacity. So working together with the previous owners of our property and then slowly taking on the reins. And they, yeah, did their first sort of full crop solo in 1997 and have been doing that ever since, which is awesome.
Excellent. And Lauren, your decision to go back to the farm from a corporate role, I mean, at your age, wanting to go back and do that, is it an unusual thing? Were people surprised?
Originally, I think the decision surprised some people. Often people who had, you know, that family farming background themselves thought it was awesome and a really exciting thing. People who maybe aren't as close to the industry sort of scratched their heads a bit and thought, why would you want to leave the city to, you know, go to a farm hundreds of kilometres away from the nearest, you know, shopping centre? But no, I haven't regretted it one bit, and I'm still based there full time, even with the new corporate role I've got. So I'm really lucky to sort of now have the best of both worlds in a sense. But yeah, it's been great. So I've done now one full cotton season end to end. So I've been there for all the steps of the journey in a full time role, and sort of, yeah, getting across the business together with mum and dad and the team there has been great.
Yeah, that's amazing, Lauren. It's such an interesting and impressive story that you have. And we're so lucky to have you joining us today to introduce Australian cotton to our audience. I'm curious, what exactly, you know, we're recording mid-August. What exactly is happening on your farm today? At what point in the harvest or season are we at right now in Australia?
So right now it's winter in Australia. For anyone in the Northern Hemisphere, it's a bit cold. So we're between cotton seasons effectively. So we picked the last of it in mid-June. The last of that's now being ginned at our local cotton gin. We've got some winter crops in. We're doing a lot of preparation, I guess, for the summer and peak irrigation season. So fixing and upgrading irrigation infrastructure, as well as planning our summer rotations. So that will include a mix of probably corn, sorghum, and in particular cotton.
Yeah, we're talking about farming systems particularly. When you're planting cotton, you're also planting other crops. How do you make the decision on what to plant and when, and what's the main driver of that decision?
So sort of taking a step back, I guess, our farms in total are around 2,600 hectares, with a majority of that being irrigation or irrigatable. And then again, half of that we can irrigate using what we call lateral move irrigators, so sort of big, long, low-pressure overhead sprinkler systems that drive up and down a field and just apply a little bit of water at a time. Or we can irrigate using what's known as furrow irrigation, so starting up sort of long black siphons, we call them, and they sort of just, you know, run water down every second row of cotton that we've got. So given that most of our area is irrigation land, very much what informs what we plant is how much water we have available. That water comes from a number of sources, so obviously rainfall, which, you know, can be quite variable in Australia. So whenever you're planning, you have to take into account that there could be quite a lot of variation between what you've planned for and what actually happens. And there are a couple of strategies you can sort of use to mitigate that. But at the end of the day, yeah, nature plays a big role. We also get some of our water from the ground, so groundwater. We sit on the Great Artesian Basin, which is sort of a huge underground water system that covers about 20% of Australia's landmass. So we can tap into that. We also have access to river water and have rights to pump once the river is running at a certain level, so that, you know, the environment gets what it needs, and then after that farmers can start tapping in. So yeah, so very much what we plant is based around how much water we have first and foremost, but very much also we look at a rotation that benefits cotton and benefits our soils to stay productive in the long term. So that could include things like putting wheat in over the winter, so that we, you know, have a good amount of stubble on top. So the stubble helps insulate the soil to sort of firstly reduce evaporation of moisture out of the soil, as well as ensure that the water that does hit when it rains can infiltrate the soil really effectively and down the sort of more fibrous root system of the wheat. So where cotton is a taproot and it goes down really deeply, the wheat is sort of a much shallower fibrous root system, which helps break up the soil and make sure that water can get into all the pockets at every level.
So with that, do you when you rotate, you don't plant cotton back to back. So you plant cotton and then you plant wheat or something into that paddock and you move that around. Why would you have that type of rotation, Lauren?
Yeah, so we generally aim for a 2-year rotation. So cotton in one paddock every 2 years is sort of what we aim for. So even if we have more water, we'll really try to avoid doing that, both from a soil health perspective and also being able to sort of capture more water and build up that soil's moisture profile over time. We'll have cotton in. Once that's picked, we'll mulch all of the rest of the plant, whatever's left over. Then we'll put in wheat, generally as a winter crop, straight in afterwards. That will be a winter crop. The following summer, it'll either be fallow or another grain pulse legume, one of the options, and then it will become cotton again the following summer. So really sort of coming down to, you know, how much water we have, what markets are doing agronomically, what's going to be best is what we consider.
Yeah, already I think so much of the conversation has lent to the importance of water, and cotton specifically is a crop that relies very heavily on water availability, despite the fact it's a very resilient plant. I think Australia is home to some of the most efficient and innovative cotton farmers, a lot because of the work you need to do for water moisture management. So could you touch a little bit more on what systems are used on Australian cotton farms, like what type of irrigation systems you use?
Absolutely. It's often said that Australian farmers are farming moisture, not actual farming. So we're really trying to maximise to sort of, use the language that we use at that cotton forum, Ema, more crop per drop. Mm. So, the systems that we have in place, and there are others out there, but the main ones that we employ, as I mentioned before, so the furrow irrigation. So what you have there is you create furrows down a paddock. First you laser level the paddock to make sure there's a small gradient sort of from the top to the bottom to allow the water to travel at an ideal speed so that it leaves enough behind for the plant, but it doesn't just sit there and evaporate and go to waste and waterlog the plants. So that's sort of the first step when you're setting up your farming system. You then have water go down channels, and every 2 meters, we work in a 1 meter system. So every 2 meters, so every second row, we'll send water down that, down that row. And it should really ideally just leave enough behind to give the plant what it needs, a full irrigation. It leaves sort of roughly, say, 100 mils behind. And then whatever's captured or left at the bottom, whatever comes out, we capture and recirculate and use in another part of the farm so that we're really not losing any of the water in our system. The other way that we irrigate is using travelling irrigators, so lateral overheads. They're essentially these long steel frames with sort of like shower heads coming from them to water the plants. And they're very much a type of precision agriculture, I suppose. So you can choose exactly how much water you'd like to apply to a paddock based on what the plant needs, and then it will go faster or slower to apply that amount of water. The good thing about that is that you can really choose how much the plant needs. So if, you know, it leaves more room effectively if a rainstorm comes, but you've just irrigated with an irrigator, but it's a little bit, there's still room for the system to capture that water. Whereas if it goes onto a paddock that's just been irrigated with a furrow irrigation system, you'll get much more waterlogging of the plant. So it has a bit of a negative impact in that regard. Obviously a high cost of investment. So around about half of our area, we've made that investment in. Anything beyond that, you want to really be making sure that, you know, you're able to use that in as many years as possible. So we've sort of estimated that in 9 out of 10 years, we'd be able to use all of those machines on our farm. So that's how we've developed that. The other thing that we employ is moisture monitors. So looking, you know, at different depths throughout the soil, how much water is there? What do the plants need? Our monitors actually take lots of different bits of data, including weather data to, you know, forecast how hot is it going to get, how cold is it going to get, What crop stage is the plant at? Our agronomists also go out and look to sort of verify all that information and ground truth it. And from there, we can estimate when we need to be watering and how much.
And Lauren, that that water that you're talking about is highly regulated in Australia. It's expensive and it's licensed. So there's no such thing as free water. I'm assuming that's why the investment is so high, to make sure that you get every bit of crop for every drop of water that you use, right?
Yes, exactly. So water is very much the limiting resource in our system. So that's what you're always trying to maximize for, on both, you know, a production and financial level, I guess. Extremely, extremely regulated in Australia. There's quite a long history, particularly between, you know, cotton, water and the environment, I think. And we've learned a lot of lessons along the way, the industry. So making sure we put all of that into practice. And cotton's quite a... I think it's sometimes misunderstood. Like, I've worked in other industries where, you know, you've got tree crops and trees need water, whether it's a financially viable year to do so, or whether it's raining or whether it's dry or not. They always need water to stay alive, which means that there's a really high pressure on a system to deliver that water to those trees, even in years of drought. With cotton, if there's no water available, or if the markets, you know, aren't where they need to be to produce cotton viably, cotton doesn't get planted, something else just gets planted, and the same amount of water will get used. And I think that's sort of a concept that sometimes is a little bit misunderstood.
Yeah. And I think it's probably a little bit unique too, because, you know, there's a reason why Australia grows some of the highest yields in the world, and that's because of the cost of production is so high, and there is no support mechanism, there's no support program. So I think the innovation that's come about in the Australian industry is driven by that absolute need to be at the, you know, at the top of your game when you're growing any crop, particularly cotton, that's expensive to produce.
Absolutely, yeah. No, there's Australia famously has little to no, actually, subsidies, which I think that, coupled with, you know, quite a variable climate, has really driven the culture of Australian farmers to be very innovation-centric. They've had to pioneer to survive, and they've had to keep developing to survive. And I think that really shows, sort of, particularly in the cotton industry, where we've also had to fight for a social licence. That they're now amongst sort of the leading in the world.
Yeah, and I will just say on that, we don't call it support program, but we do collect a levy from the grower when they gin their bale. There's a $2.20 per bale levy collected that the government actually matches that. And that's the R&D, the research and development levy for the industry. So any of the, you know, the seed varieties that are produced to improve yield or quality, et cetera, that it's a self-funded, if you like, a self-funded R&D position for the industry, which again drives that innovation even further. Katie, you were going to say something?
Imar, it's so interesting that you say that and you bring up that levy. I think what sets Australia apart from so many other origin markets is the fact that there is so much investment that goes into R&D and new technologies, especially around the water resource management. You know, Lauren, I'm curious to know, how has technologies and new technologies over the last several years even changed Aussie farming systems for you and your family?
Yeah, so when my parents started farming, that was in the era before we had genetically modified cotton. When I was a child, I remember planes flying all the time in summer. So basically there's like a really intense pest pressure from the Heliothus bug, which, yeah, meant that before we had genetically modified cotton, we had to be spraying sort of once every 5 days when it got really, really bad, just to control this one insect, which, you know, is not good for anyone. It's not good for people. It's not good for the environment. It's not good for the bottom line. And I think that really made everyone question, is this industry viable in our area? Is this the end of cotton in our region or in Australia generally? But then with the development of, you know, through biotechnology, having genetically modified cotton plants meant that, you know, all of a sudden none of this spray had to be applied, only very little in comparison, not as much. And then on top of that, you know, we've really tried to implement other systems such as integrated pest management to further reduce our need, to the point where 2 years ago we actually didn't spray a single time for any insecticides. Which, you know, is just an absolute achievement when you think about where the industry was 25, 30 years ago. And in addition to that, I suppose, yeah, all of our traveling irrigators, that's been a huge change. That's something we only started with sort of in 2007. You know, before that, everything was very, very manual, not as precise. Same thing with the water monitors that we have. Cotton picking has very much changed in that time as well. We used to have at least three different machines to do cotton picking. So the cotton picker, the bowl buggy, and then the module builder, which, you know, meant big days, long days, much more dangerous working as well in a team environment when it was picking time. That's now done all with one machine. So that's been a huge step up as well in terms of technology, having a single round bale picker to do the job of what essentially at least three machines used to have to do. Also a much lower labour requirement. And it's a lot safer too, because everyone's sort of in the machine. No one's running around at night in the cold. Lots of other examples too. Camera sprayers are probably the next big thing as well, where, you know, instead of spraying the entire area to get all of the weeds, you're really only spraying the single weeds. There are cameras that can identify weeds, in some cases weeds from other plants as well, so you can go through in a crop that's already growing. Green on green technology is coming in, so yeah, which massively reduces how much again pesticide you're using in your system as well.
One thing I'd like to ask you a bit about was the IPM, integrated pest management. So we have a lot of insects in Australia.
Yes, we do.
Particularly spiders.
Yes.
That's why I could never move to Australia.
I happen to have my niece and nephew from Ireland with me at the moment, and is there a bug anywhere in the house? We need to look at it. I think the spiders are particularly beneficial, aren't they, Lauren? So the integrated pest management, can you explain how that works on your farm?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a system that I guess has evolved over time, and we're quite lucky in that a lot of our neighbours sort of have adopted that system too. I think it's one of those things when you can do it at scale, it's so much more effective. So the basic premise of it is you've got good guys and bad guys, and the good guys eat the bad guys. So when you go out into a crop, and this is very much done sort of by our agronomist and their teams, I used to work for our agronomist as well in the summer holidays. So I was one of the field scouts. I got to go count all of the bugs by hand day in and day out for the summer. You go out, you physically try and get all of the bugs out of a cotton plant. You look at them on a sheet, you identify which ones are which species. They broadly get categorized into, you know, what's a beneficial and what's a harmful pest. And then from there, you look at the ratios. So you understand sort of who eats who, the general force of nature, how quickly certain populations can grow or be contained by others. And you use that to inform, you know, a lot of your agronomic decisions. So you might have a lot of pests, but if you have double the number of good guys and you know that, you know, in a week's time they'll have controlled that population, then you don't have to be as worried and you sort of let nature do its thing. It's pretty amazing now at the point where, you know, even just like green tree frogs we have jumping around the place, that apparently wasn't a thing when I was a child, which I don't remember that in enough detail, but we now, you know, get photos from our agronomists of there being bird's nests in our cotton crops, which just goes to show you how good an environment it is and, how many bugs, I guess, are around as well to feed them.
Yeah. Well, that kind of puts pay to, I know a lot of people get very concerned about GM in any kind of plant, but there's a very regulated system as well, not just with your IPM, but you have a refuge crop, which is a certain percentage of your farm, which doesn't have any BT, you know, intrusion. So that's also part of the of how you manage pests on the farm, Lauren, isn't it? What's the percentage of refuge that you have to keep?
Yeah, so we have around about 5% of the equivalent area of what we have planted to cotton right next door to those cotton areas needs to be planted to certain what we call trap or refuge crops. The idea of those is that they act as a refuge for the same sorts of insects, I guess, that are in the cotton, that the cotton has been genetically modified to, I guess, work against or kill by the protein that they express in their leaves. The more pressure that's on those plants, the higher the chance that they will become immune to those changes in DNA in the cotton. So by having the refuge crops those insects can breed with each other, and it reduces the chance that those traits might get passed down. It's regulated pretty stringently. You know, you have to collect eggs from every sort of area once a week, send that into the lab where they'll then raise those insects and actually genetically test them to make sure that they're not developing resistance to the genes in the cotton.
Mm-hmm. And obviously all of those things, the water management, the genetic modification, the efficiencies on farm with the spraying, et cetera. It's all adding to one thing that Australian growers are pretty much the envy of cotton growers around the world, the yield. Lauren, what's the yield? What was the yield on your cotton farm this year?
Our yields were around about 11 bales a hectare for the season, which per acre, if we have to work that back, what's that per acre? Four and a half?
Okay. Yeah, bit over 4.5. Yeah, very impressive. Yeah. And I mean, yields around Australia, again, depending on growing conditions, etc., they have been known to get up as high as 17 bales per hectare. So, you know, it is a bit of a standout.
Yeah, no, where we are is by no means the highest yielding area either. We tend to be I don't know if lower input is the right word, but definitely a cooler climate cotton. So we don't get as many heat units as, say, people further out west from us do. Which naturally sort of limits, I guess, the ceiling for us. Always trying to push that higher, but yeah, sort of if we get above 10, we're happy. 12 is what we're aiming for.
So Lauren, we've spoken quite a bit about how you plant and farm your cotton. We also briefly mentioned that Australia lacks any sort of government support scheme for farmers that you might see in markets like the United States or India to protect farmers on the downside of market volatility. So I'm interested to know more on the marketing side of your production. How do you decide when to sell your cotton?
Good question. So we try to reduce the volatility, I guess, in the market by forward selling. So we'll look at our long-term average production, and based on that, we'll forward sell a certain percentage of what we think we'll safely produce, say 2 to 3 years in advance, probably no more than three. And then each year they're on, just sell a little bit more and a little bit more. And then once we get closer to the season, we'll roughly know our position a bit better, how the season is shaping up. But we'll be marketing all the way through the season until sort of when we're picking the last cotton and know exactly how much we'll have. But it's very much a multi-year process to sort of try and ride out those waves in the market.
And who are you usually selling to?
So we generally market with a handful of different merchants in Australia. We have one sort of close local cotton gin that we gin all of our cotton with. We often also deal with them when we're marketing, as well as to like one or two other marketers in amongst that. So yeah, we're not actually selling to the end customer. It's very much, yeah, there's a middleman and they then arrange export and further marketing from there.
Yeah, it's really everything that comes off that farm has a value, has a pretty high value. Pity the market is in the doldrums at the moment, Lauren. It's not looking as good as it was for the last couple of years,
is
it?
No, it isn't. We need people to buy more T-shirts. More cotton T-shirts, I should say, because they are buying more T-shirts. It's just less cotton T-shirts.
Well, speaking of that, I mean, we just had the Australian Cotton Conference, and it was, I think we had a record over 2,800 people attended. I'm not sure the exact number, but it was definitely over 2,800 people attending, which is phenomenal. What was the learning from the Cotton Conference for you, Lauren? What was a big takeaway?
Yeah, I think sustainability, but also just how the world maybe is viewing textiles at the moment, and that cotton is losing market share to synthetic fibres, and in particular how in Europe at the moment the legislation is, you know, potentially going to come out that oil-based fibres effectively are going to be seen as more sustainable than cotton fibres or other natural fibres, all natural fibres, which... Yeah, to me, really highlights the disconnect, I think, between maybe consumer understanding or decision makers understanding and reality, at least as I see it.
Yeah, Lauren, I thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time to chat with us. One more question before we let you go that we are asking all of our guests. What is one thing about cotton that you would like our audience to take away with them today?
I think that it's not as water hungry as everyone thinks it is. Like, it needs water, but the water is going to be used no matter what. It's very much what works best in a lot of systems. It gets the highest return, which in turn benefits regional and remote communities the best as well. So just because it's thirsty doesn't mean it's evil.
Great answer, Lauren. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, what a great conversation with Lauren. I feel like I learned so much from that conversation.
Yeah, look, it never ceases to amaze me. You know, we trade cotton all the time, and, you know, it's all about the, you know, the basis and the futures and the bales on boats, etc. But when you actually get back to have a look at what farmers are doing on the land, it continues to fascinate me, particularly the systems that they use and the planning that they have to put into it all. And I love her story. I love the fact that she's, you know, choosing to go back onto the farm. I think that's great.
Absolutely. I mean, I particularly loved, just in closing out that conversation, her fact about cotton she wants the audience to walk away with, that cotton does not actually overuse water, which is, funnily enough, one of the main myths about cotton that we in the ICA and in the cotton industry are trying so hard to dispel. This myth that, you know, cotton is, of course, a thirsty plant, but it's not overusing water or taking water away that would be going elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I think that fits so particularly into Australia, right?
Look, it does. And I mean, the reason why we have irrigated cotton here too is because the climate is so exceptionally variable. You know, we have really deep drought seasons year after year. And then we have flooding events that break the drought. So we have very big El Nino and La Nina events, and, you know, they're getting probably deeper for longer as well. I mean, you know, we've got a bigger cotton crop now than we thought we were going to have because we had rain at the time that we wouldn't normally get rain. So there's so much planning to be done for farmers around this, you know, how the climate shift is happening. And, you know, water, whether it's available in abundance or not, the crop only needs a particular amount of water, and the grower has to manage all of that. And it's when it's not plentiful, it's such a very precious resource. And I think, isn't it true, Katie, that over half of the global cotton production is rain fed anyway? And I know we've seen in Australia so many growers having to go to rain fed percentages to grow their crop because of the variability of the season. So they might hold water on their farm for some irrigation, but they'll still plant cotton right if they have a little bit of moisture in the soil, because it's the best return for investment. And, you know, that's what it's all about, isn't it? Sustainability and managing the resources that you have.
Right. And it's so interesting because, you know, hopefully consumers are listening to this podcast, and our audience may have some idea about what sustainability means in the textile chain. But at the beginning of the chain for farmers, it can mean something completely different. And it makes, I think it's so interesting, we started this series on cotton farming practices in Australia, because farmers there, as we said, are so invested in R&D, and there's so much going on in the technology development space on farms in Australia.
Yeah. And I think that's one thing that for me is really important for the next generation of people to go back onto farm. You know, they're not sitting on tractors in 35 degree heat day after day, you know, plowing the way that their parents did. It's a completely different way of farming. And I think that precision agriculture that Lauren talked about, and that really fascinating, you know, ag tech space where they've got green on green camera technology where the camera can decide whether it's a cotton leaf or a weed. I mean, that's fascinating stuff. And you get these
so interesting
graduates coming out of university very happy to go back onto the farm because they can actually apply some of this technology in a really meaningful way, and again enhance the environmentalist approach that growers have to have.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it's so important to tell these stories like Lauren's to inform people about the supply chain. It's a very valuable way of getting the word out and sharing what's happening in this technology space, and the fact that things really are changing in the farming space.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's such a privilege for us to be able to bring some of these stories to the broader public, because really people don't understand what goes on cotton farms. It's so easy to be critical about something that you don't understand. So in our small way, we're hopefully bringing that awareness to the broader public, and people will look at their t-shirts now and be a little bit more understanding of what the effort and the systems, the farming systems and practices that go into making a t-shirt or any other cotton item for that matter.
Yeah, exactly. I hope so. And this is the first in what we hope to be a series of going to different origins and interviewing different farmers and people in different parts of the world. Cotton is a counter-cyclical crop, so it seems that someone is always harvesting and someone is always planting at some part of the world. So it'll be interesting to hear from different farmers over the next several months.
Yeah, that's for sure. I'm really looking forward to, particularly to the areas in on farms that I've never been to, like the places in India, for example. They're doing an awful lot of work on the smallholder farms there for innovation as well. So, and hopefully by having this series, we'll be able to introduce farmers to farmers, and they'll be able to help each other. So we might have a positive unintended
Absolutely,
consequence
yeah.
from this. Well, Katie, look.
Absolutely.
Before we wrap it up, I just want to say thank you for your help on this podcast and for the ones that we've just done. And I know you're taking a break to go and study for a little while, and it doesn't mean that you're leaving us, but you won't be talking or chatting with us for a little while yet. But I really just want to say thank you so much for your work and your support with Women in Cotton, and I look forward to the next time we can get together and record something as interesting as this. And good luck with everything that you're about to do. And yeah, we'll have Katie back on the podcast very soon, no doubt.
Thanks so much, Imar. It's been such a privilege and an honor for me to be able to work on this podcast and to work with you and Camille and everybody else in the Women in Cotton team. So thank you all so much, and I'm sure we'll be back in this space together soon.
Once a woman in cotton, always a woman in cotton.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Thing About Cotton. We hope you enjoyed the first episode in our new series about cotton farming practices. Catch us next time when we speak with Jennifer Ilkew, president of ICE Futures US, about her journey and the role of the futures market in the cotton value chain. If you want to learn more about today's episode or have other questions about the cotton value chain, feel free to email us at podcast@ica-ltd.org. Don't forget to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google, and follow the Women in Cotton group on LinkedIn and Facebook to find out about our upcoming episodes, events, and engage with men and women in the industry. Special thanks to the International Cotton Association for giving us this platform to deliver the podcasts.